Subversity here on KUCI. This is Dan Zhang. The opinions expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the regents of the University of California, nor the management of KUCI. KUCI is at 88.9 FM in Irvine.
When your icebox is bare, eat the rich. Show your stomach you care, eat the rich. Pull the rich ass of the power, I think it's a shame. Swelling out the problem, but we know who's to blame. And I'm tired of bearing it loud, best you could get, eat the rich. Yum, yum, yeah, eat the rich. Yum, yum, yeah. Chemicals in your food. Eat the rich.
Yum, yum, yeah.
Now don't you think that that's rude? It's gone. Eat the rich.
Yum, yum, yeah.
You're listening to Subversity here on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. The opinions expressed on the show are not necessarily those of the regents of the University of California, nor the management of KUCI. Today, we're going to discuss the whole issue of recovered memories, and also academic freedom in the same breath. With us in the studio is a new professor here, a distinguished professor of sociology and psychology here at UC Irvine, Elizabeth Loftus. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Why did you come here? I mean, you kind of made a big splash in Orange County with all this press coverage and one of the top people in Orange County, according to one of the local magazines.
Well, gee, it's a long story, but there are a couple of reasons that I came to UCI. First of all, I got a great offer to come to a fabulous place. There are people on this faculty who are amongst the world's greatest scholars in areas that interest me, psychology and law, and also in memory, especially human memory. And so I knew I was going to have some exciting colleagues and collaboration. This place is really great in the intersection between psychology and law, and that's one of my chief interests. And the offer just happened to coincide with my being a little angry at my former university for what I felt was interfering with my civic freedoms.
Yeah, we'll talk more about that later, about what you do as a researcher and also what you do as a journalist, I guess, in a way. So we can discuss the differences maybe between those two tasks, because I kind of am a kind of journalist also, but sometimes I think I'm doing research when maybe I'm just doing journalism. So we can talk about that.
Well, research is a big word, and I mean, you research the kind of pasta you want to buy or a car you want to drive, but there really is a question about when something is. Lots of things can be research, but when is something research that you have to ask somebody for permission to do? I mean, you wouldn't be asking for permission to go out and talk to friends and acquaintances about what kind of car they own and whether they like it. When does it become something that you need to ask permission for?
Right, because I interview all these people on this radio show. I don't go ask for an institutional review board if I can talk to you.
Well, yeah, good point. And then does the school newspaper, do they go out and ask for permission too?
Right. But it's ironic that you came here because the IRBs, which are these institutional review boards, are actually gearing up right here and very strict, actually. Because some teachers actually don't even assign certain oral histories in school, in classes, because they're worried that the students may have to go through this whole, IRB test. The IRB here has a 20-minute exam that you can take on the web to go through, to acquaint yourself with all the issues, I guess. I haven't taken yet.
Oh.
But actually, that's not true, because I think they're now saying that if it's a course-related material for courses, it's not subject to IRB. But if you want to publish it, if it's a student paper that's going to be published somewhere, then the student has to go, even an undergrad has to get permission.
Okay, well, that's interesting. Publish where? What if you're... writing an obituary for somebody. You know, what if you're
right.
writing something for the church about somebody who died, and you're remembering them, and you ask a few people
right.
what they thought of the poor deceased.
That's for sure.
I mean, that's publishing, so that still doesn't quite let you off the hook.
It also has to do with whether secondary analysis of data or original collecting. And I'm a data librarian here also at the school, and we collect a lot of stuff that was originally collected somewhere else. And so students and faculty use it for secondary analysis. So the rule now is that they have to submit a proposal, even if it's secondary analysis, even if it's census data. And they
really?
have to get exempt. They will be exempted, but they have to go through the paperwork.
Hmm. Well.
So you don't know what you're getting into. But actually, it's I guess. Do you want to? Later on, we can talk about that. But basically, you don't argue that there is no any that memory doesn't play a fact in people's lives, right? You're not saying that.
No, of course memory does. I mean the question that I usually get asked is, do you believe there's such a thing as repressed memory or massive repression? I've been involved in these cases recently where she goes into therapy and she's got one kind of problem. Maybe she's depressed, or maybe she has an eating disorder. Maybe she's not that interested in sex right now. And she ends up with a therapist who says something like, you know, everyone I've seen with those symptoms was sexually abused as a child, and I wonder if anything like that happened to you. And there begins this process of trying to dig out these allegedly buried trauma memories. In the process, a number of patients, clients have had false memories planted in them. And that's the kind of situation that I'm concerned about. The ability of coercive and suggestive interviewing, either by a therapist or by someone else, to lead people into false beliefs and false memories.
So it's more that they are asking leading questions?
They're asking leading questions. Yeah. They're suggesting reading material. They're putting people in group therapy with other people who have abuse memories. And even when you have an individual who has absolutely no memory of any kind of massive trauma, you end up with people who will sometimes come to believe and even remember that they were raped for a decade, that they were raped in satanic rituals, that they had to participate in animal sacrifice and baby breeding and baby sacrifice and the works.
That whole thing about SRA, I guess, sadistic ritualistic abuse.
Satanic ritual abuse, yeah.
That's been debunked, right?
Well, in the minds of a lot of people, but not everyone. There are still those out there who think that people like me and others who are skeptical are just pedophile protectors and dangerous people.
So did you think about that when you did this research? Were you worried about the backlash when you first started?
I mean, no, when I first got into this latest wave, when I was asked to be an expert witness in the trial of George Franklin, he was accused of murdering a little girl 20 years earlier, and the only evidence against him in the murder trial was the testimony of his now grown-up daughter, who said that she'd repressed her memory for seeing the murder, she repressed her memory for years of sexual abuse, and now this memory after therapy had come back to her. And it was that case which got me interested in the whole subject of massive repression, where supposedly years of brutalization is banished into the unconscious. And when I began to look for any kind of credible evidence for this idea, there wasn't any. There wasn't any, and yet people were being convicted. People were being dragged through civil litigation. Families were being destroyed. It was a big mess out there.
So your focus, your criticism is on recall data, basically, that is suspect.
Well, first of all, that there is no good evidence for this idea of massive repression. And then secondly, there is good evidence for the idea that strong suggestion and coercive interviewing can lead people to false memories. So that combination of truths made me skeptical about these repressed memory claims.
What year was that case?
Well, Franklin was tried in 1990. So that was about 12 years ago.
Were you also involved in the McMartin case more locally?
Well, I was, and that was a different kind of case in the 80s, when the McMartins were arrested for allegedly abusing kids in the daycare center. I mean, that was a kind of case we'd seen a lot of, the mm-hmm. accusations being brought by children who were still children. And those were a little bit different than the accusations being brought by grown-up, mostly women, making claims about something that happened to them in their childhood. But the theme that tied these cases together, when they're false, I mean, and I'm ignoring the true cases because there are clearly true kid cases,
sure.
and true cases of people who, were molested, maybe
yeah.
didn't talk about it for years and finally got the courage to tell a friend or a trusted therapist. But what the false cases have in common is the theme of suggestion and suggestibility.
Do they also often have the same therapist kind of as a common factor?
Well, there are certain therapists who seem to be major contributors to the false memory problem.
In the McMartin case, there was that one person from that institute.
Yes, she was considered a key, and in fact, those were some of the most suggestive interviews that anyone ever saw.
So now, do you think they've learned the lesson, the psychologists or even the prosecutors? Do they try not to ask suggestive, people that interview kids, I mean?
Well, certainly a lot of people have learned that there is a science of suggestibility, that they are more careful. There are people teaching, doing workshops for therapists who advise being careful, and some excellent people who teach
yeah.
not to lead. But the word hasn't gotten out to everybody. And so there are still people out there doing harm and wrecking families.
Because we've interviewed Alison Clark Stewart on the show on that very topic.
Well, she's great.
Yeah, well,
she's
one
great.
Of the reasons you came here, too, that she was here.
Well, she's fabulous, and I'm thrilled to have her as a colleague.
Do you think the fact that has this to do with politics or what, or money or what? How come these things seem to happen in waves, or at least the press coverage of it? It seems to every decade there's a new scandal, and then there's all this hysteria, maybe moral panic over this, and then it recedes, people forget about it, and then another decade comes.
Well, it is interesting to think of what's going to come next, but I don't know what caused this to happen. I think one of the problems is that, let me just speak about the adult repressed memory cases where the therapist sees a patient with certain symptoms and has only one theory or hypothesis for what might be going on, namely that sex abuse is at the root of it. But not all depression is due to sex abuse, and not all endometriosis is because of sex abuse. And I think if these therapists were to entertain some alternative hypotheses and learn something about the scientific method, maybe we would have seen less of this problem.
Is the problem anybody can put up a plaque and say they're a therapist?
Well, it would be easy to say that the problem could be solved if it. That is true. In the state of Washington, where I moved from, and I'm too new here to know all the rules in California, for $78 and taking a 4-hour AIDS awareness class or test, you could put up a shingle and call yourself a therapist. And not everybody can distinguish between therapists and psychologists, psychiatrists, and the different kinds. So that. Got there and got their credential because of different kinds of training. So one part of the problem is that you do have some, not very well-schooled mental health professionals, but you can't blame it all on that, because some of the worst offenders and some of the people who have been defendants, the therapists who've been defendants in the biggest lawsuits, are people with MD degrees and psychiatrist after their name.
So it's a political thing, maybe, that they believe this, and so they become advocates for victims.
Well, that's part of what's going on, yes.
Right.
Yes.
Do you see yourself as an advocate for the falsely accused?
Well, I'm very passionate about the problem of false accusations. I just... Something I've always been that way. I remember, when I was at UCLA and I was on the student discipline committee or something like that, always wanting to give people a second chance. Maybe there's something in my makeup that makes me particularly concerned about the false accusations. But
how about the feminist movement and the sex wars debate and the danger versus pleasure? Was that any factor in your life?
I don't think so. No, no, it's just a concern about the falsely accused, and justice is kind of a strong feeling of wanting and needing to see, to live in a world with justice.
Did that come from as a child too, when you were growing up, or how did you get that sense of, you know, kind of fighting for justice, social justice, whatever?
Well, I guess I'd have to think about how far back it went, but at least it went back to college.
And at that time, there was no, I mean, it also has to do with, in terms of your looking at the McMartin case, one of the theories going on at the time was that children don't lie, that they don't lie about things that that's so bad. Do you think that's true?
Well, that was a, you know, that was a motto that was floating around. But first
mantra,
of all, our mantra, a good word. But they may, you know, they, first of all, they do sometimes lie. But a bigger problem is that they can be led to believe that, and to say that certain things happened that didn't. And that's what you have to be careful about.
So do you think, it's hard now for, are there still cases? I know you're a defense witness a lot of times. Are there still cases going on in which false accusations are made right now?
Absolutely. I mean, now this is in a slightly different type of case, but when you take a look at what is happening with the new developments in DNA technology and the number of cases of wrongful conviction that finally proven once and for all that these are absolutely mistaken convictions. And the major reason why somebody does get convicted wrongly is because of faulty memory. So it's usually, you know, faulty witness memory. So we know from that DNA technology just how fallible memory has been in a number of cases. And some of these people were on death row when it was discovered they were innocent. Some of them spent 7 years, 10 years, and longer in prison for crimes that they didn't do.
So when somebody asks you to get involved in a case, how do you decide whether you want to get involved?
Well, I guess a lot of things go into it. I might be more inclined if it's a death penalty case because the death is so significant.
So you're against the death penalty, are you, normally?
I kind of like to, I worry about the death penalty because I worry about false accusations and that we will execute somebody who's innocent. I worry about it. I think if somebody is convicted of a death penalty crime and they end up getting convicted and there's really good evidence and they say they'd like to be executed, I don't see anything wrong in that case. But I really worry because I've seen a number of people and met those people who were on death row who were innocent. And so I do worry about it. Then I might take a case if it's somewhat unusual. I mean, the first time I got a case involving a chance to go testify in one of the Bosnian war trials, I thought, oh, that's pretty unusual. You know, take a trip to The Hague and, you know, see what it's like to watch a prosecution in The Hague. I had a case that I took because somebody, the client was 90 years old, and he was being sued by his 60-year-old daughter, who claimed that she had just remembered abuse occurring 57 years earlier when she was 3. And I thought, oh my God, this is the oldest one I've ever seen. I got to take that one.
Yeah.
So if there's some interesting twist, or if I really, you know, feel in my heart the person is innocent, or sometimes, you know, if timing, sometimes it's just a matter of timing. I'm teaching, I need to be with my students. If something comes along that's going to conflict with that, then I have to say no.
You probably know a lot of attorneys now, right, by now?
I do. I know quite a few, 100 or 1,000.
Are they friends or are they just colleagues? How would you characterize them? Have some become friends?
Sure. Some of my best friends are attorneys. So, sure.
But do you favor, in general, you don't testify for the prosecution, right?
Well, I have actually consulted with the prosecution on a number of cases. I've testified once, but you've got to, you know, it's a very unusual case where the prosecution would want somebody to come in to talk about the problems of human memory and the scientific evidence that reveals those problems. I mean, you think about it. It's usually the prosecution that has the person with the memory, and they want the jury to believe the memory. So it's the defense that has got the problem with memory. But one case that I did testify, it was a case in Wisconsin, and in fact, I brought this case up when I was doing some recent media interviews on the Beltway sniper case, because what happened in this Wisconsin case is a woman disappeared. And she disappeared one evening, and there was a mad search to try to find her. She was gone for months, and there was a lot of publicity about her car and the license plate on the car, because it was an unusual license plate. It was HB, and then the number 2, and then the letters ME. Happy birthday to me. She had bought this car for herself for her birthday. So they showed the license and the car all over television in this town in Wisconsin, and all kinds of people called in. They said, I saw it. For months, they were seeing it everywhere. It turns out it was impossible because she was at the bottom of a big body of water inside that car.
Oh, inside the car, yeah.
Inside that car. So why were people spotting the car, spotting the license plate, calling in with tips? It was because of the power of suggestion from the media, and people started to convince themselves that maybe they saw something vague and brief, and they convinced themselves they'd seen that.
Wow.
Kind of like what happened to the white van in the sniper case. I mean...
Right. They said they saw a white person.
White van.
They thought the sniper was white also.
The profilers were convinced it was a white person. Because usually it's, white guys who are serial killers. So that was a big surprise.
Well, hunters. Also. So do you think that if somebody today was accused, a priest was accused today, and there's, like, some priests have been defrocked, I suppose, because of lots of cases from dating, 50 years ago even, or 40 years ago, say, and now they're 80 years old. Do you think some of those cases could be so-called recovered memory that doesn't really exist? Or how do you know it's true or not then?
Well, first of all, in many of those priest cases, the person isn't even claiming I repressed the memory. They're saying I just didn't tell anybody about it. I didn't think about it. They are not dredging up memories that are highly implausible and perhaps even impossible, the way you would see in this repressed memory, the more traditional cases. They're not relating to periods of time like I remember you molested me when I was 1 year old. They're relating to periods of time where certainly it's possible to form long-lasting memories, and as teenagers. And so those are some of the ways in which many of those priest cases differ from the other kinds of repressed memory cases. But I can tell you, I've already been involved in a number of cases where the abuse never happened, and the accusations are false.
This was a priest.
Most famous one is Cardinal Bernardin from Chicago, mm-hmm. who was accused by a young man, and eventually that young man retracted his mm-hmm. allegations. They'd been brought about through hypnosis and through a little massage therapy and some other techniques that enabled this man to come forward and make this report, but he eventually took it back, apologized, and so that priest was exonerated, thankfully, before he died.
So do you think that in terms of this policy the Catholic Church is implementing right now, do you think there should be kind of zero tolerance after any accusation?
Oh, gosh. It's going to be a weapon it's going to be a net that's going to be woven so tightly. It's going to bring all these little innocent fish in along with the guilty ones, and we've got to worry about that. What happened to innocent till proven guilty?
Well, it's kind of a witch hunt, I suppose. I mean, some people argue. because of this concern about protecting children.
Right.
Yeah. Do you think there is such a thing as innocence among children? You've studied a lot of children, right?
Well, I can only tell you a little bit about memory, you know, and suggestibility.
Yeah.
So if you want to know about other things about children, then you have to ask a different psychologist, and we've got some good ones on this campus.
Yeah, okay. We're talking with Elizabeth Loftus, who's come from U of Washington to Irvine to work here and do research here. The number here is 824-5824, area code 949. The opinions expressed on the show are not necessarily those of the Regents of the University of California, nor the management of KUCI. How much of a factor, when you were looking at these false accusations, how much was a factor was the fact that there was a lawsuit, maybe a divorce case or something, or money? They could get money from somebody, church or whatever.
I think that's an issue, and that may... That may mean that I see a different set of cases than the set of cases that other people see, because I see cases that get into litigation. I see the most hotly contested of the cases.
But we earlier talked about the difference between research and journalism. If you're doing a court case, that's not really, is that considered your own research or no? Oh, I mean, it's at some level it's research, but do you write a professional paper based on that, or how do you distinguish between your courtroom appearance, your journal, your writing, and then your research writing?
Well, in some ways it's hard to separate them because the research I do that's clearly scientific research involves doing manipulations with large numbers of subjects and using the scientific method to analyze their responses, the responses of large numbers of people, and then writing it up using scientific custom and so on. When I'm hired as a consultant in a court case, it's, you know, I'm working on one individual case, but I will certainly talk about that case not only at cocktail parties, but also with my students in classes. It illuminates the scientific material. I'll use those the brief descriptions of those cases as anecdotes to open up my scientific or popular articles or books. So it's a little hard to these activities kind of blur to some extent.
How do you find the time? I mean, I saw you this morning, and then I see you now. But I'm sure you're so busy with all these appointments, all these other activities.
Well, I'm pretty busy, but I'm also efficient, and I like to do many things at one time. So
do you get to? You have time to write.
I do. We are in a publisher parish world here. So
even at your level, which is distinguished professor.
Well,
you like to write, right?
I do. I like to. Well, I like to communicate the ideas. Yeah. I mean, I don't want them to just stay in some file drawer somewhere where nobody learns about them, and they can't do anybody any good.
Because a lot of people might be surprised why you're willing to talk to the media and willing to be on the show or whatever.
Oh, why do that? Well, I'll tell you why academics will sometimes do that. It's because it's science is, it belongs to the public and the public pays for it, and I think we have an obligation to give it away. Also, when I speak to a jury, I'm educating 12 people at a time. It's very inefficient. If I speak to a class, my largest class at the University of Washington was 150 people. I mean, it's a little more efficient. But if I write an article for Scientific American magazine, for example, I can reach millions of people. And if I get on a program, what's particularly the Oprah show or something, millions and millions. And if you care about educating people and making a more scientifically literate society so that people are out there, making better judgments and not uncritically accepting claims that are so dubious, then what better way to educate than to do this?
But with this kind of outreach, there's also the possibility of a kind of, what do you call it, not fallback, but reaction negative reaction. Have you gotten
I've death had my share of that. Yes, I have. Yes, I've had the bomb squad at my house, and you know, a woman in an airplane figuring out who I was and swatting me with her newspaper. I mean, there, it's a crazy world out there.
Hasn't happened yet here. I mean, I know you've been in some interviews, and locally too, but. I mean, nobody showed up at your office to track you down or anything. Like.
No, people have been very nice here. It's been really great, really, really great.
And you're very friendly with people, too.
Oh, I mean, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, I saw you in action this morning, and you're saying hi to everybody that walks by.
Don't you wish more people would do that?
Maybe it's the Washington thing, huh? I'm not sure. My mother actually went to U of Washington.
Oh, she did. Yeah. Really? Did she? What did she study there?
I think English, but that was in the 20s, I think.
Oh,
the 30s, yeah.
Okay.
And so I've never lived in Seattle, but I grew up in Asia.
Oh, you did.
And she went
Where
Hong Kong. Yeah.
Oh.
But then I went to Michigan, and I noticed in one of your co-authors in this article that caused this controversy at Washington is from Michigan.
Yes, Mel Geyer has a law degree and a psychology degree.
Right, I think he was there when I was there, maybe even.
Probably, because he's been...
I was in grad school, yeah, there.
Okay.
And so it's kind of interesting. Maybe we could talk about that case, why you think it was, why you believe that it was really academic freedom at issue at the time.
Oh. Well, I maybe I just should say a little bit about what happened. I read a case history that was out there. It was published. It purported to be a true case of repressed memory, a true case of a woman who had supposedly been abused by her mother, molested by her mother over a period of years, and then repressed it and recovered it when she was 17 years old. The psychiatrist who studied her had videotaped this memory recovery, and he was showing the videotapes all over the place. And I read this article. I started to see this case being used in court cases against innocent people. I thought it was very fishy, but I thought, well, how am I ever going to find these people? 280 million people in America? But it turns out, because it was all disguised, it was Jane Doe, John Doe, Mom's Town, Dad's Town, I found these people.
You went through court records and stuff.
Well, there were many steps in the process. I taught myself how to search Social Security death records. I came up with a few possible candidates. I then got newspaper obituaries to see if I could rule out some candidates. Eventually, I found these people. And when I found these people, I got somebody to, they lived in another state from where I was living, and I got somebody to see if the mother, the accused mother, who I by this time believe was falsely accused and had lost custody and visitation of her six-year-old more than a decade earlier,
yeah.
When the person that I hired knocked on her door and said, I'm here because there's a woman from out of state who has taken an interest in your case and thinks you're probably innocent, this mother just sobbed and sobbed and sobbed, and she said, I never thought this day would come. So I, of course, felt like the millionaire. I don't know if you're old enough to know what that means, but I felt like the millionaire, and I basically had to go meet this mother.
Mm-hmm.
So I and my now co-author from Michigan went to meet the mother and learn a little bit more about the case and read through every one of the years and years of court records from 5 years of an ugly divorce battle, and we just became really convinced that she was innocent, and we were going to bring her a little justice.
So you read the court records after you found her?
I had read some of them before, because some were sent to me, but there were so many, and it was $1 a page to Xerox them.
Mm-hmm.
So the person that I'd hired to look through them and just sent me a few of them, but that was enough to already become very skeptical. But and other things that I found, I was skeptical. But once I went through the whole file myself, now I was really skeptical. So we were about to publish this expose of this case that we felt was incomplete, if I were being generous, and maybe even misrepresented, even if unintentionally. when the grown-up daughter complained to my university, and she said her privacy, she heard somebody was looking into her life, and with 15 minutes notice, they came to my office and seized my files. And that's a very upsetting thing when it happens to you in an academic office. Yes.
The university, some scientific integrity office or something.
Right. So it took me almost a couple of years and, you know, a hefty amount of legal fees, personal legal fees, to get my files back, get the right to publish the story, which I was able to do this summer right before moving to UCI, and to be free.
And they did this against Mel Gaia first, right?
There was an inquiry at Michigan. Yeah. They didn't seize his file. They weren't nearly as bad to him at Michigan as my university was to me. And I was promised before I came to UCI that it wouldn't have been as bad. It wouldn't be that bad. It wouldn't be like that. I was promised by various faculty members who were in a position to know something. So anyhow, so...
So do you lock your files off campus now?
I'm not telling you where I'm keeping them. I'm not telling you.
But at issue was whether or not you had the right to do this kind of interviewing, I guess.
Well, how about when I met the mother and she said, I never thought this day would come, and you know, and then I met her. I mean, was I conducting human subjects research without human subjects' permission? I need their permission. I mean, there is a First Amendment right in this country. We have freedom of association and freedom of speech, and I just believe that my university forgot about that for a while.
So I guess they were thinking that basically that's First Amendment is subservient to kind of IRB policies or something.
They were winging it as they went along. It was trying to nail Jell-O to the wall, trying to get a handle on what was on their mind. But
apparently what happened was the daughter had complained or sent an email to the university or something.
Right.
So they just freaked out and they didn't...
Right, they freaked out. They, you know, is she going to sue us and whatever. And
they didn't ask you before what was going on. They just did it. They just came...
I suppose they said, are you looking... Here's this email.
Oh.
Is this true? Or answer this. I said, yeah, I'm looking into this case.
All right.
So they went that far.
Yeah. But generally, do you think, I mean, I guess a lot of professors do write op-eds, and so they engage in some kind of journalism. You know, they want to educate the public about some, you know, issue that they have research experience on. They want to pass on the knowledge.
Right.
Or they want to take a position that, you know, enter the political debate even, or whatever, any debate.
That's quite frequent, yes.
Yeah. But they don't, I don't think a poli sci professor would have to submit their op-ed to IRB before it's published. It's almost like the CIA that you have to, you know, lifelong secrecy and you have to get clearance before you even go on a radio show probably or something.
Well, at issue here is when is talking to a human being a matter of personal interest? When is it... a piece of research,
right.
But research that you'd never dream of asking permission to do, such as, you know, researching the kind of car you're going to buy. And when is it research that's a little more closely related to maybe some scholarly interest you have? And when is it human subjects research requiring human subjects permission?
So it's not just that you use, I mean, I think the position of university might be that if you use the name of the university, you have to get clearance in your research, whatever that is.
Well, no, I wrote an obituary for a colleague who tragically died and talked to people about what they thought about him. Nobody ever said I had to get and my name was and university was on there that I had to get permission to publish the obituary. So that can't be, you know, that can't be it. The problem is the rules haven't been well defined. I just didn't think that I should be the guinea pig. For them figuring out, you know, what we ought to do in a university situation.
Are they afraid? Is it because they're afraid of losing federal money in research grants? Because research grants have all these, you know, requirements for going through IRBs. So they afraid of, or is it more just afraid of publicity, bad publicity from this person that complained?
Maybe both of those.
Yeah.
Maybe a fear of a lawsuit of some sort. I mean, it's hard to know why they acted so precipitously, but...
Did the chair of the department support you?
Oh, he thought it was a setup. I mean, that somebody was setting me up, but he didn't know what to do. He didn't know how to end it. But he was my chair, Michael Beecher. He was wonderful. He was sympathetic. He was a good colleague to me. He just didn't know what to do.
He couldn't stop the raid on the...
He couldn't stop that freight train, you know, heading down that track at the speed it was going.
I mean, I don't understand how a university official anywhere could go and seize stuff from an office. You know, it seems to me you have to have a warrant. You have to, you know, whatever. I don't know what you need, but you at the very least, you need a search warrant or something.
They didn't think so. And they didn't think so.
Huh. Because I know that I've had a faculty on my show talking about email. And one of the administrators here said that in the UC system, they've actually seized computers' drives because somebody complained about something, or maybe it was part of some court case or whatever.
Right.
But now under the Patriot Act, they could actually seize a lot of things without even telling other people that they've done it, like library records, for instance.
Oh, that's, yes.
The new concern.
See if you're checking out books on bomb making and things.
Or reading Islamic literature or something, maybe, whatever. So under the Patriot Act, the librarian is not even allowed to tell somebody that the FBI has issued a subpoena.
Oh, really? And what happens if you do?
It's penalties, I guess.
Oh,
So it's all top secret.
Wow.
It's just
now, have you been getting, you know, training courses on how to...
No, I'm not.
How to deal with this in your role as?
I'm not a high up, you know, librarian, so I don't think. Oh. I mean, the FBI would come to me to try to get somebody's records. But I'll be the last person to come to. But so are you really distrustful of? I mean, would you still submit an IRB for your, for approval of your regular research?
Of course. Yeah. In fact, I do that, you know, many times a year. Of course. Yeah. It's a good thing to have human subjects, you know, real human subjects be protected from, I mean, the kinds of abuses that once went on, leaving prisoners who have syphilis untreated to see what would happen, those horror stories we hear about from the past. And so we have a system in place that is meant to help people who need to be helped, but it just got a little crazy in this one instance, and it's not the only instance. I mean, you in your wanderings around campus, at least when you're talking to scientists, social scientists, and other kinds of scholars who interact with humans, there are, you know, people love to complain about the IRB these days.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. I know that some people have stopped even asking, you know, for projects and classes because they worry that all this paperwork, even for students, although, you know, I think they're still learning. I mean, the IRBs are still coming out with procedures. They're refining it, at least. You know?
Yes.
But here there were all these medical scandals, basically, medical research scandals, and that's why they became very strict, I guess.
Right.
Yeah. So, but back on the topic of recovered memory, so you're not against the idea of having memories about events. I mean, you know, people went through the Holocaust, people went through Cambodia, went through, you know, a lot of things. So there are events that are very traumatic. You know, history and memory, how we look at history depends on what kind of memories we have.
Well, now that's you mentioned these horrible situations. It's interesting because in the beginning, when I was starting to be skeptical about these cases where people were saying they'd, you know, been raped for a decade and massively repressed it all for 15 years, and one, I'd say, just show me some proof, and they'd say, well, you know, what about the Holocaust? And, you know, how come? You read, I've read many books on the Holocaust and have even been involved in some of the court cases arising out of the Holocaust. If you read, for example, Lawrence Langer's book, Holocaust Testimonies, there's a line in there, it's too bad they don't have repression as a way of coping with some of these memories. And so when I say, you know, really there isn't too much evidence for repression, and they aren't coming out of the Holocaust saying, oh, you know, I had such a great time during the war, and oh, now I remember it was awful, then those who wanted to make a comparison with the Holocaust would back off and say, well, sex abuse is different. In the Holocaust, it was a collective experience, but the sex abuse, it's private, and there's guilt and there's shame, and therefore it's different. But that isn't going to fly either, because, you know, when you stop for a minute and just to think that when she stole the bread from her sister and the shoes from her cousin out of desperation during the Holocaust, she felt terribly guilty and full of shame. So there was plenty of guilt and shame to go around in the Holocaust, and still you don't see massive repression of those experiences.
How about in the Japanese internment situation? A lot of parents don't talk about it to their children, but you don't think that's repressed then?
Well,
a lot of the Japanese-American parents that went through the internment, their children didn't know anything about it, you know, until maybe the reparations issue came back up. But
it might be one thing, you know, you would want to talk to some of these individuals. I don't know that they would be claiming repression, but just I wanted to not think about it and not talk about it. But not that, I mean, the theory of this massive repression is that you had to repress it because it was so painful, you know, you couldn't go on in life unless you banished this out of conscious awareness, completely unaware of it, but it's sealed off in some compartment, and at some later time you can lift the veil of repression and there's this pristine memory. That there's just no support for that.
Is one of the proponents of that Ellen Bass and her group of people?
Well, Bass is the one of the co-authors of The Courage to Heal, which is a book about four victims, survivors of sexual abuse, and it's a big book. It's in some ways a comforting book to the genuine survivors, but it's been heavily criticized because it has highly suggestive things to say for people who have no memories. Things like, if you think you were abused but you have no memory, or your life shows the symptoms, then you were. It's accused of encouraging fantasies of castration and revenge, and encouraging lawsuits, and encouraging false memories. And that's why people have complained about that book and that author.
So is memory like a blank slate originally, and then you just put things in? I mean, how is memory stored, I guess?
Oh, my across the street neighbor, Ruben Rumbaugh, who's a well-known sociologist, new professor here, gave me something that he wrote, which quotes a novelist, an Uruguayan novelist, who said that memory is born every day. And I think that's perfect. It's perfect. Because really, what it means is something that we know as scientists in the area of memory, that memory is reconstructive, and that we are taking bits and pieces of experience from different times and different parts of our life and combining them together to create memories. So we don't play back a videotape. We construct something new when we remember.
So you could have false memories implanted. And we could.
Yes, because we're perhaps thinking about a past experience in a new context.
I read that you are building some kind of lab. Are they building a lab for you, constructing something on campus here? It sounds like a big warehouse or whatever. What is it? What's going on here?
No, it's not a warehouse, but there you need a place for the graduate students and the postdocs to be, and to we run the subjects and we gather data from people about their memories, and
it's like a controlled experiment.
Doing controlled experiments, and then for computers, for inputting the data and analyzing the data and preparing the presentations and so on. So it'll be in the social ecology. Maybe I shouldn't say where it is. I don't want the enemies to to stop by unwanted, but.
So that was part of the deal that brought you here, then? Did you have such a lab up there?
I did.
Oh, okay.
I did, yes.
Yeah.
So I'm basically I mean, it's going to be a nice place, and then the equipment will all be brand new. But I had, that's the kind of situation that I had in Washington and where the research was done. Unless we were doing something out in the field, but most of my experiments are done on campus.
In a controlled setting.
Right.
Do you, when you leave this institution, are you able to take everything with you, or how, I mean, I know, do they own anything that, like even, like a grant, if you got a grant there, right, a research grant, I mean, can you take that with you to another university?
It depends on the arrangement that you have. I mean, it completely depends on the arrangement and what the policies are of different universities.
Funding agencies.
Funding, exactly.
So were you able? Were you able to take?
Well, I'm gonna get all new equipment here.
No, I mean the grants. I mean the research monies. Were you able to transfer some over down here or no?
Actually, I had to leave some money in Washington. I was forced to leave a chunk of money, but I still have a postdoc working there.
Oh, I see.
And so he is going to be spending some of it. But I brought the students, a number of students with me. So.
Oh, some students came down here.
Right.
They were able to enroll here.
Yes.
Oh, so they'll be able to get their degree here.
Right. I have two students here, Kara and Aaron, who are both enrolled in psychology and social behavior as new graduate students, and they'll be getting UCI degrees when they're done.
So is what you attracted you to, what attracted you to this school is this kind of applied focus of, you know, kind of applying, looking at social issues and trying to get a way to use science or scientific method to apply it to kind of social research?
Well, I do love thinking about my studies in the context of real world problems. So, and the legal field is just an ideal place because human memory is so important to the resolution of legal cases. But I do like it if my studies also are answering some fundamental question about the nature of memory. And so I am very interested in some fundamental questions, the kind of things that I might talk to a memory person about who isn't that interested in application. So a question like, if I plant a false memory in the mind of someone, and they now are telling me, I believe this happened to me, and I even have a little bit of detail about this event that never happened. What are the consequences for that person? If I plant a false memory that when you were a kid you were a victim of a vicious animal attack, for example, a dog bit you and you were badly injured, if I plant that false memory, will I make you like dogs less? If you go to the pet store, will I make you want to get a different kind of pet? I mean, will you behave and act and feel and think the same way that someone who really did get attacked viciously by a dog would behave and act and feel? So that's a fundamental question about the nature of memory and the nature of false memories and how they're alike or different. And I hope to do some more exploration of that issue.
Because I'm always intrigued by the people who who are abused, who use one memory of one, like say if they were abused once, that dictates how they look at life forever, it seems. It seems like but to me, a lot of people have bad experiences. I don't, I was abused, but I don't blame everything on the fact I was abused. You know, why is it that some people think of one incident in their life or even a series of incidents, and that becomes the determining factor?
Well, we have a culture that tells people that it's okay to do that, and it's a very convenient explanation for your problems. I mean, if you've got problems in life, and we all have problems to some extent, but if you've got problems in life and you're looking for an explanation, I mean, you've got at least three explanations, A, B, and C. C, you're crazy. That's not so good. B, you're bad. That's not so good. A, you're abused. And some people would prefer that as an explanation.
So it's an easy option to take, and because it makes your life easier to live, I guess, if you have an answer for it.
You have an answer. And it's not your fault.
Do you think it's also, in your research, are you going to work with psychobiologists and look at how,
Well, there's some great psychobiologists here. They call themselves neuroscientists now.
Right,
but they're, I mean, it's world-class, top people. in Jim McGaw's department,
right.
What he's done here is incredible.
So there's some kind of fruitful collaboration possible.
Yes, I hope so. I mean, in fact, we're trying to organize a lunch already. So far,
how do you find Orange County? Do you think it's, I mean, I know Washington is pretty liberal, I suppose, Washington, Seattle, I suppose. Do you find...
Well, fortunately, I hang out, with a lot of academics, and so we have a lot in common and a lot to think about and talk about. And then there's a matter of, I have set up my computer, so the first thing I see every morning is the weather in Seattle and the weather in Orange County. And
well, today's a picture postcard day, right?
it's perfect, exactly. And I know that if I were to plot these two lines, they would be more and more and more diverging. And
last week, I think it was more like Seattle, given all the rain, but this week is better.
People promised me that was an exception.
Right. I mean, usually Southern California doesn't get that much rain. Because I had a friend who worked at Microsoft, and he came down to Irvine to visit. He was a former student, and it was a week that was pouring rain. He was so upset. He escaped Redmond, and he came down here, whatever. And it was the worst week. Yeah. But do you, in terms of students, are you teaching this quarter? No.
Well, I'm not teaching a regular class right now. As I build the lab and get settled, and I've got decisions to make about lots and lots of things.
Are you going to teach undergrads?
Yes, both. I'll teach undergrads and grad students. Yes.
What kind of?
I'm going to teach eyewitness testimony next quarter.
Oh, that's interesting.
A whole course on the psychological studies of how memory works when people see crimes and accidents and other legally relevant events, and then a little bit about the legal reaction to eyewitness testimony and cases of wrongful conviction and
right.
the role that faulty memory plays in those cases and what the system can do about it. So it's very nice for being at the intersection of psychology and law, and I hope to attract not only the psychology students, but also those in criminology, law, and society, which is the other department where I have an appointment.
Do you think there is likely to have to come out of this project, like they have at another university, say, to look at cases, kind of Project Innocence or whatever they call it?
Innocence projects.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
Of course, the Innocence Project, which was started in New York with Barry Scheck and Peter Neufeld, I mean, it's taken root in many other places, and I'm not quite sure what is happening in Southern California in terms of various interests in Innocence Projects, but I've been involved in other Innocence Projects and contributed my time to helping with people who have been identified as good candidates for an Innocence Project to pursue. In the state of Washington, we worked on the Wenatchee sex ring cases and freed the Innocence Project there. I played a small role, but freed every one of those falsely convicted and accused people. And now many of them have recovered significantly in civil cases.
Wow. So
no one accused them of talking to human subjects without permission.
Wow. You could do... I guess you could always do, say you're doing freelance or whatever.
Right. Now I'm going to get $1 from everybody I help from now on. And then I'm a retained person.
Well, thank you very much. Our time is up. Thank you, Elizabeth Loftus.
You're welcome. It's my pleasure.
Talking about recovered memory and false accusations. Thank you. This show is on the web. This show will also be digitized.
Oh, really?
And it will be on the web in real audio at go.fast.2/sv. Go.fast2/sv with periods in between.
That's hard to remember.
Go.fast.2/sv. Or you can go to the KUCI website and click on the schedule for today and click on Subversity, and then it will goes to the Subversity website, where there are links to Professor Loftus's web pages and here and at Washington, where she has linked articles by her and about her. a full list of articles, including a long one in the Register that is three pages in the paper, maybe a few dozen pages when you print it out, but a long piece in the Orange County Register last Sunday, a week ago.
Oh, yeah, we should mention that great journalist, Amy Wilson. She did a fabulous job.
You were very open to her, huh? I mean, you don't mind being so personal.
Well, she's an easy person to talk to.
That's great. So thank you very much again. Coming up, another show here. This is KCI 88.9 FM in Irvine.
Okay, Dan, that's good. Hey, what's the number for...